please join me in 1 Samuel chapter number 14. We're going to begin at verse 36 in just a moment. This is the aftermath of the Battle of Michmash, which Saul carried out against the Philistines. This is taking place in the second year of King Saul. I think it's in the fall of 1036 BC. The real hero of this day is Jonathan. He's the one that actually believes and trusts that God can save with as few as God wishes. So he started the fight against this massive Philistine invasion force while his father was kind of delaying and hesitating over at Gibeah. But once it was discovered that the fight was going on, Saul led his 600 guys across the ravine and into the midst of the Michmash battle. The Philistines are broken, and they begin to retreat westward. And they are being dogged horribly. God has sent a localized earthquake against them. Jonathan is acting as one filled with the Spirit of God, like the judges of old. You've got some of the Israelis that had been cooperating with the Philistines have now turned on them. Israelis who had deserted once they saw the Philistines on the run, joined in chasing them down and killing them and capturing them. And they have retreated all the way down to the flatland near Ajalon. And then the sun goes down and the day of battle comes to an end. Now, Saul had put everybody under a mandatory fasting oath because he thought that that would be beneficial. Jonathan inadvertently violated that oath by eating some honey because he didn't know anything about it. And once he was told about it, he criticized it, that things had gone much better if the people had been able to eat while they were pursuing the Philistines. So they start eating the spoils of war. They start butchering the animals, but they don't butcher them kosher because they're trying to eat them. Seems like they were almost eating them raw without cooking them after they hadn't been properly bled. So Saul jumps in and makes sure that everything is kosher, killed, and cooked. But then this happens, verse 36. Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them." So King Saul feels that the Israelis should continue their pursuit during the hours of darkness and kill as many more Philistines as they can before the Philistines can get back to their fortified cities. The response of the military leaders and the people is this. They said, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." So Ahijah, who is the great grandson of Eli, he happens to be in the camp of Israel with the Ark of the Covenant, or at least the Ark of the Covenant had been at Gibeah earlier. And this Ahijah seems to be wearing the high priest clothes, or at least he has the Urim and the Thummim pouch with him. The Urim and Thummim were the two stones that were kept in a special pouch behind the high priest's chest piece. And it was used to get yes or no answers from God through the priest. So this priest says, "You know what? We really ought to check in with God before we start chasing Philistines in the middle of the night." So, verse 37, Saul inquired of God. And here are the questions that he asked. Shall I go down after the Philistines? That would be a yes or no question. Will you give them into the hand of Israel? That's a yes or no question. But look at the next line. He, meaning God, did not answer him that day. Now, we've talked about the Urim and the Thummim before. As I said, it's two stones used to divine the answer of God to certain questions. Some people have suggested that they were two separate colors of stones, one black, one white, perhaps. And the priest would reach into the pocket and pull out a stone, and one color designated yes, the other color designated no. Well, that can't be the answer here, because that would always work. You'd always get a yes or no answer. So I happen to go along with the Jewish tradition that there was a supernatural element to the Urim and the Thummim, that they glowed. Yes, they were two separate colored stones, but the answer was indicated by the stone starting to glow with the light of God. And that would be very obvious that it wasn't working. So we do not know what Saul had in mind for his pursuit, because he never got to do the pursuit, because God won't answer him as to whether or not he should pursue. So he immediately assumes that there's a problem with today's battle. Now, this goes back in history. There are times we've seen in Scripture where Israel can't get a victory because there is a sin that has been committed. So Saul makes that assumption. Verse 38, Saul said, "Come here, all you leaders of Israel, all you people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For as he who is lives who saved Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." So, hey, I want to know what's happened today where somebody sinned. Did somebody violate my vow to not eat? Because that was the big thing that was on his mind. And he even says, I don't care who did it. If even Jonathan is the guilty party, we will execute him because we need to get back in the good graces of God. Now, this again shows that Saul, in his second year, is already falling apart as a godly leader. He is making threatening noises as part of his leadership. And the people don't respond. It says there was not a man among all the people who answered him. Because apparently people knew, at least a few, that Jonathan had broken the vow, even though Jonathan didn't intentionely do so. Verse 40, then he said to all Israel, "You're going to be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "You do what seems good to you." And therefore Saul said, "Oh, my master, he who is of Israel." See, that's the divine name. Apparently, I think it's got the, if I can find it here real quick. I think it's got the divine name plus Elohim in it. Yes, that's it. So, my God, he who is. Okay? So, he divides the offending parties into two possible groups. Either he and his son or everybody else did it. And then he causes the answer of God to be checked. Why have you not answered your servant this day? Is this guilt in me or in Jonathan, my son, O he who is the God of Israel? Give the Urim. But if this guilt is in your people, Israel, give Thummim. So he brings out the Urim and the Thummim again in the hand of the priest. And he says, all right, God, I know there's a problem. So you tell me, who's at fault? Is it everybody else, or is it me and my son? And Saul said, cast the lot between me and, Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. So apparently the stone glowed this time. But it was the Urim that glowed, which Saul had said is going to represent him and Jonathan. And he was probably shocked by this. And so Saul said, well, cast the lot, or ask the question, between me and Jonathan. And Jonathan was taken this time. And Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. And Jonathan told him, yes, I tasted a little honey on the tip of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I will die. Now, he'd already told the other Israelis, what my father did by putting that vow into place was wrong. It was inappropriate. It caused Israel to suffer and not be as good as they could have been. But because he is a man, that is Jonathan, is a man who believes in the Word of God and living by the Word of God, he feels that if his father made the vow and he believed that Jonathan broke the vow, then he needs to follow through with it and execute his own son. So verse 44, Saul said, God, do so to me and more also. You shall surely die, Jonathan. So he believes that Jonathan is a traitor to him as father and king because he broke the vow, even though he didn't know about it. And even though Jonathan is the hero of the day, he's going to execute him because he believes Jonathan is the reason that God wasn't talking to him earlier about going after the Philistines. Now, thankfully, the people know that Saul is completely in the wrong here. Verse 45, then the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it, as he who is lives, there shall not be one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die. Now that sounds as if the people as a group declared that Saul's vow was inappropriate, that it had not been offered correctly. So they redeemed Jonathan out of the vow, probably by offering a sacrifice in his place. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to their own place. So there is no more chasing Philistines at this point. That is over with. And you see here a bit of a breach between King Saul and his heir, Prince Jonathan. Now, the next few verses highlight the military career of King Saul. Verse 47, when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, that's on the east side of the Dead Sea from Israel, against the Ammonites, that's on the eastern border with the annexed territories east of the Jordan, against Edom, that's to the south and a little bit east of the Dead Sea, against the kings of Zobah, that's north of the city of Dan, and against the Philistines, that's on the southwest border of Judah and of Dan and Ephraim, down in that area. So the western side of the United Tribes. Wherever he turned, he routed them. So he begins taking on all of the border enemies of Israel. Verse 48, he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. Now that's the beginning of his fight against the Amalekites. Verse 49, now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, that's the eldest, Ishvi, and we'll talk about this, the names later, and Malchishua. The names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merib, and the name of the younger, Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimoaz. The name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, who was Saul's uncle. So here is a relative of King Saul functioning as his military commander. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. So Saul is the king, his cousin Abner is the military commander, and then you've got Prince Jonathan as well that we've already met. We got another couple of princes, we'll know more about them later, and then a couple of princesses. Verse 52, there was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. Now that's, again, getting back to something that God had Samuel warn the Israelites about. If you get a king of the type that you want, Israel, he's going to start drafting your people into his service. He's going to have a standing army. He's going to have support for that standing army that he'll draft people into. So the end of chapter 14 tells us that Saul was doing exactly that. He's drafting people into his service as he sees them useful to it. Chapter 15. Samuel said to Saul, "He who is sent me to anoint you over this people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of he who is. Thus says he who is over the armies, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt." So that's more than 400 years ago. Amalek, which was functioning as slave traders, at least in part, back at that time. They had intended on capturing the Israelis as escaped slaves and selling them back into slavery. And they ended up killing some Israelis in the process of trying to capture them. So God put a curse on Amalek back at that time that they would eventually need to be eradicated. So now we're coming to that time. Verse 3. Saul is being spoken to by Samuel. Verse 3. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. So Amalek has come under an execution order from God. Not just simply for what happened in the past, but for the way they're doing things in the present. They're on the south border with Israel, and they are causing a lot of trouble. So Saul has been given the order, it's time to execute the Amalekite people. Verse 4. So Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, somewhere down in the south. 200,000 men on foot and 10,000 men of Judah. So a pretty good force that shows up. Saul came to the city of Malek and lay in wait in the valley. And then Saul said to the Kenites, "Go, depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. Now, the Kenites here are the descendants of Moses' in-laws, some of whom had mixed in with the Israeli territories. They were Bedouins, so they didn't have houses. They just had tents, and they moved their sheep and their cattle from place to place. So some of them are living down in this region next to the Amalekites. Because the Israelis are on friendly terms with the Kenites, they are warned of the impending attack. So you need to get out of here. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. And then Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt. Now Shur seems to be the dividing line between the flat sands immediately east of the Nile Delta and the mountainous rocky areas of the Sinai Peninsula. Shur has to do with a wall, and so that seems to be the reference. Havilah is farther to the east, and so the Amalekites are stretched out all through this region. And Saul defeats them during this military operation. Verse 8, he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Now, he wasn't supposed to do that, but he did. And he devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. Now, he didn't get all the Amalekites. Some of them escaped. And they will continue to cause trouble for the Israelis all the way into the future to the book of Esther. Because the bad guy in the book of Esther is a man by the name of Haman, who is an Agagite, which means he's a direct descendant of this guy right here that King Saul has captured, King Agag. So some of the princes had clearly gotten away, and they reproduced and almost were able to annihilate the Jews far into the future. That's how bad they are. They hated the Jews so much that they wanted to annihilate them. All right, so back to the story in 1 Samuel 15. Verse number 9. Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and of the fatted calves and the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless they devoted for destruction. So this is a direct violation of God's explicit instructions that everything that belongs to the Amalekites was to be destroyed during this war. And yet they keep the king and they keep the good animals. Now they plan on sacrificing them once they come back to Gibeah or wherever it is that they were going to gather to after the war was over. But that was a violation of God's instructions. So this is another clear sign that Saul has gone rogue. He's gone bad. Now, how far into this is it? Well, this is all happening in about the next dozen or so years after Saul began his kingship. So he's making the rules up for himself as he goes along, as if he were living in the period of the judges. Now, verse 10, the word of he who is came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king. Now, the word for regret here is actually, it's an onomatopoeia. It's a word that expresses a sound and therefore the emotion that kind of comes from that sound. And it's an exasperated exhale. So God is basically saying, Saul makes me sigh exasperatedly. So I am sighing that I made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. Now Samuel was angry and he cried out to He Who Is all night. This gets Samuel all emotional. Now, the word for anger here can also mean that he was just very upset emotionally. Because think about this. Samuel is the public figure that anointed Saul. He's been kind of promoting Saul all along to the people. And now God is saying, Saul's a bad guy and I need to get rid of him. So this is going to, in Samuel's estimation apparently, make Samuel look bad. And so he feels bad about the situation and he talks to God and apparently begs God to please just let Saul stay on. Verse 12, Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning. He's on a mission now. We're not going to get to the fullness of it until tomorrow. It was told Samuel, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he has set up a monument for himself and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal. Now, this Carmel is not the mountain Carmel up in the north. This is the southern Judah city of Carmel. It's about 10 miles or so, I think, south of Hebron. So it's somewhere in the vicinity of where Saul finished up his Amalekite war. And he sets up a monument celebrating his own victory. And once he does that, he goes back to Gilgal in the Jordan Valley down near Jericho to finish up his tour of duty in the Amalekite War. And that's where Samuel is going to catch up with him. Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed be you to He Who Is. I've performed the commandment of He Who Is." And Samuel said right back to him, "Well, what then is this bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen that I hear?" And that's where we'll pick up the story tomorrow.